Welcome to Business Ninjas, brought to you by Right For Me, where you'll hear from business leaders who are out there growing their business and slaying it every day. Learn from the masters. Let's get started.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back for another episode of Business Ninjas. I'm here today with Jason Goldsmith. He's the Senior Director of Donor Medical and Analytical Sciences, Sirius Therapeutics. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, excited to have you. So, Jason, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I'm kind of an odd bird. I started out in academia and was on the, you know, the tenure track faculty path, pushing towards all of that type of thing, putting in my faculty grants, applying for tenure track positions at the end of postdoc, having kind of taken a tour from traditional clinical medicine, because I'm an MD, PhD, and decided to more do the research side when my PI during the pandemic decided to suddenly leave for another country. So as a result, I had to expand my job search out from tenure track positions, because usually it takes a couple years to get, and my grants were still cooking. And so I turned my LinkedIn profile on, said I was looking for jobs, and a recruiter found me and said they were looking for someone with a combination of host microbiome experience and plasma experience. And I happened to have side gigged as a plasma center medical director for most of my time while I was a postdoc. And so yeah. I was the one person in the country with both skills, and I ended up at Sirius Therapeutics. And it just kind of happened to be a luck that this happened. That's led to a wonderful job. So I always say, you know, your career path, even for a planner like myself, isn't always what you think it's going to end up. So these days, I'm the scientific and medical head and the director for all of our donor program at Sirius Therapeutics. Mm-hmm. I also sit on the manufacturing leadership at the company. And because I'm a physician scientist, I also work a lot with R&D and clinical. And because for most of high school and even afterwards, I did a lot of IT work, I helped drive a lot of the enterprise level GMP software solutions from the business owner side. So I work partner very extensively with IT and then quality for all of our GMP software and help put out a lot of the enterprise solutions that we have.
That's really interesting. So it sounds like it's been a really interesting journey getting you to Sirius. So tell me more about Sirius.
Sure. So Sirius is a pretty cool company. It's a late clinical stage biotech company, and we're focused on microbiome therapeutics. And we're currently seeking commercial approval of our first drug, which is known as SER-109, which is an investigational microbiome therapeutic. I like to think all of those things together are pretty unique. Most biotechs never commercialize a drug, let alone in a novel therapeutic space. And the concept of using living bacteria, especially in an oral formulation, hasn't been around for that long. And so being this close to potential commercialization is really exciting and unique as far as a company goes.
Is it that, you know, that people haven't had the opportunity to release something like, you know, the SER-109 that makes
yeah, it's the timeline of it, right? So the concept of fecal microbial transplants had been around for a while, but there was only kind of enough body of evidence to then lead to companies deciding to exist outside of academia 15-ish years ago, which is when Sirius was founded. We're one of the oldest, if not the oldest, microbiome company. I don't actually remember the order, but we're
out there
on the old side.
Yeah.
And that's not that old. And no. So then to be as young as we are and have a drug that we're trying to bring to market right now, so we're, as I said, in the middle of FDA approvals, really rare.
Yeah.
Right? So usually your first drug that you have as a company in phase one is not the drug that you end up going commercial with, but it is for Sirius. Our first phase one drug that went to phase one was SER-109, and it's what we're trying to commercialize right now. And you usually don't do it as quickly as we do, and usually you get bought. Wow. Right, usually at the end of phase one or phase two. Yeah. And so all of those types of things are unique. And then the fact that it's in a new area that no one's really done before is very unique, especially as an oral formulation, right? FMTs are often given by enema, and there's another product out that now just got approved that does that by enema. But like, just to have some pills is, you know, appealing to people. To say the least. To do all the hard work to convert this over is unique.
So, you know, it sounds like you've, you know, Ceres is a younger company. You've been, you know, growing, scaling, you're going, you know, you've got your first drug up for its anticipated launch. It sounds like the business has grown and scaled rather quickly then over the years.
Yeah, so I think we've almost quintupled in size since the day I joined in early 2021.
That's insane.
And there's been a lot that we've done that. So, you know, we're donor derived. So we take stool from people and then do an inactivation step to get rid of a lot of the bacteria and viruses, and we purify it down. And so into a small number of pills. And so we have a donor network that exists. And we went from one third party vendor to three in-house ones that we built out. And we've also initiated a project with Bacthera to be a new CDMO for us for sustained long-term growth. Wow. So in one sense, there's a lot of infrastructure we've had to do pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of common, right? When you have a growth phase, oh, we're ready for something big. I need a new manufacturing plant. I think a lot of people, regardless of industry in your audience, would be familiar with that. But I think something that was, I don't necessarily unique, but really important is that we did the hard work of accessing our existing projects for commercial scalability and making necessary improvements. Mm-hmm. So what works for, you know, 400 patient doses in a clinical scale, or maybe the cost per unit can be higher or what have you. You're mostly caring about time to get out and getting it done good and right and quickly versus scale up aren't necessarily the same. And so it's important to remember that what doesn't work at early stage clinical companies doesn't necessarily work at a late stage clinical company, and definitely would be a struggle to work as a commercial company. Mm-hmm. And so I think at each step, it's critical to take that time and look at the processes for long-term sustainability. Mm-hmm. Like, is the third-party vendor you're using now able to handle your volume? Very simple example, right? Maybe when you're young, the big vendor doesn't want to talk to you because you're not big yet, right? And so you go with a smaller shop and they're great and that's a great partnership, but they can never meet commercial demand. And so it's those types of things that from a business perspective, as business ninjas, you have to take a step back and do those honest assessments all along the way and to be really forward looking. Otherwise you're going to build up a debt of work that can be hard to surmount. If you're ready to go commercial and don't have a commercial supply chain in place, you could be struggling for approval at, you know, you're not necessarily for approval, but for successful launch because you didn't do that work.
So quadrupled since 2021, that is a lot of growth in a short amount of time. So it sounds like kind of the one key that you're saying is sustainability and scalability are the two most important things. But, you know, through that, you also are talking about growing, you know, a workforce, growing a company and growing company culture. Talk to me a little bit about how, you know, even through a pandemic, you were able to scale the company with a positive, you know, company culture through everything that was going on.
I think culture wise, you have to like know what your company's good at, right? So I think every company has had this problem in the pandemic and has the same problem with large growth, right? So how do you, A, if you have an influx of more new people than old people, how do you handle growth? And B, with the pandemic, how do you maintain a culture when you're separate? I think a strong sense of purpose is something that Ceres has, and that has really helped aid us a lot, like bringing world-class microbiome therapeutics to patients is something that's very important for us. Yeah. And having a culture that's focused on bringing this new class of life-saving medication potentially to the market, that's big. Yeah, so that's helped. And I think something maybe more unique to Ceres, that we're not the only ones that are like this, but we experienced rapid growth in the middle of a pandemic. So we went from, you know, that quadrupling and quintupling in size in the middle of, please do not come to the office unless you have to. So as a result, we ended up developing organically as a hybrid workplace. And so it's really now part of our culture to have a mix of remote, hybrid, and in-person workers all in the same team. So I'm remote. My boss is remote-ish, but comes up to Boston a lot where we're based. We always have a weekly leadership meeting where we get together. And so we actually deliberately meet with these hub weeks on site in person to do the in-person work that then strengthens our distant work. But then it lets you recruit people you wouldn't otherwise recruit. Especially in Boston, right? There's kind of like this Boston circle of you just hire the same people who don't ever leave the city. Mm-hmm. But if you're trying to recruit really good people in pharma, you want to be able to hire people from New Jersey and New York and Pennsylvania and California and have them be remote and come out as necessary because they don't necessarily want to move with their families anymore.
Right.
Now you can do that. And we kind of figured out the magic sauce. And as we built our buildings out, since most of our sites are new in the last several years, we have really good both office space and conference space with these really nice Zoom conference setups and all the infrastructure. So it's really easy to pull people into a meeting and have a conference room where you can actually see and hear everyone and be on the screen if you're the remote person. And so it's something we've just gotten used to doing in a pretty pretty easy way.
Yeah. And why do you think it's so important to help, you know, maintain that company culture through everything?
So if you don't know, you know, I guess I put it this way, a company is a group of people, right, that are all trying to drive towards the same thing. And if you don't have a sense of culture and purpose, it can be really hard to get your team, whether your team is your five direct reports or your organization of 100 or the company of 1,000 or whatever your number is, to go in the same direction. Mm-hmm. And day to day, people are making decisions, whether it's an employee on the line or the CFO, about finances. And if you don't have a shared vision, you're going to unintentionally work at cross purposes with each other. But if you have a shared vision, you don't then have to have meetings all the time to make sure you agree all the time on every little thing, right? You come together as necessary. But if you understand where you're all marching to, then you can work towards that more organically.
Yeah.
And it's not constantly having to re-seek alignment because no one knows what they're there for.
So kind of talking about people thinking that they know things, and you know, kind of a segue into my next question is one that I love to ask, is talking about misconceptions, because people think that they know a lot about things. But as you know, coming from academia, there's not a lot of things that people know. You know, I can imagine certainly in your industry, in your space as well, that's, you know, a very fascinating, you know, industry to be in. So talk to me a little bit about, you know, common misconceptions that you tend to hear.
Sure. I think the first thing that comes to mind for me is the academia industry divide. It's notorious in that academia often just tries to promote people staying in academia, but there's not enough jobs. But then people have this view that in academia, there's a strong belief, at least that I've seen, that in industry, your research is highly directed and you don't have the intellectual freedom you do in academia. Mm-hmm. And I would actually say that while, yeah, your company is going to say, hey, research this drug target, not that drug target, we only work on this, like, don't go completely far afield, that's also actually true in academia, namely in terms of what gets funded at any given time. And so there's certain trendy topics that come up in academic fields, and those are what's getting funded at one time. And you can do some side research over here with a little bit of money, but it's really not that different from industry in the end. You have to get money to do things, whether it's the NIH or some other agency that's giving you a grant, they're only going to get money for the work that's interested.
Yeah.
Now, it can be a little broader in academia, but it's not nearly as different as you would think it is. Mm-hmm. You go to the right company where you're doing work you're interested in as a scientist and driving things, you're going to be working on interesting things you want to work on, and there's going to be funding to do that. But maybe if you're studying colon cancer, they're not going to want you to study strokes. Okay.
Fair.
That's also true of your grants.
Right.
They're going to say, why are you studying this? Unless you like have 5% time where you figure out something. And that type of thing also happens a little bit in industry. And the other, say the second conception, I think, is the microbiome. So people often think about the bacteria in our gut as a purely harmful waste product. You know, we flush it down the toilet. And then we clean the toilet. So you dispose of it and disinfect everything. But the reality is that much of the bacteria that are in intestines and our skin and elsewhere, we can get into all the spots that are bacteria. There's a lot more than people think about. They're actually highly beneficial and exist in a symbiotic relationship with us. So without them, we're not healthy. Mm-hmm. We don't utilize energy right. Our skin gets all weird. We can actually overwash our skin and cause issues, for instance. Mm. And that's really what the emerging field of microbiome therapeutics is all about. It's understanding how disruptions in this healthy pattern can lead to illness, and then designing ways to restore that healthy microbiome back to individuals to treat their illnesses. And so this can either be an a priori disruption causes a problem, or maybe something else starts the problem, but the disruption propagates the problem. And so you get, your body gets put in a vicious cycle, and on its own or with other therapies, a microbiome therapeutic could reverse that vicious cycle and halt it and let the person come back and be healthy again.
I think that's a very good misconception that a lot of people carry, because it's just easier for people to consider, like, you know, oh no, got to disinfect, got to be done, rather than talking about, like, you know, all of the important things that, you know, it, yeah, that the microbiome does for you.
There's actually a sense that some of our autoimmunity, asthma, colitis, Crohn's, other diseases in the United States and other Western societies or westernizing societies, mm-hmm, really developed are due to over cleanliness. Mm-hmm. Like, we're so clean, we develop autoimmunity.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. I have a friend who has a very similar theory to that, you know, along the same lines, but that's a story for another day. So
yeah, it's actually pretty well founded that it correlates with the hygiene hypothesis, that there's a balancing act between too clean and obviously too dirty.
Yeah. Right?
But you can actually go too far. People forget sometimes.
On both sides.
Exactly. Oh, very much.
Well, Jason, this has been a great conversation. You're obviously a professional. You know, I did a little research on what you do. So you do have your own podcast, correct?
Yeah. So I'm a co-host of the Immunology Podcast, which is sponsored by Stem Cell Technologies. And that's been really fun to do.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about it.
Sure. So it's about every 2 weeks it comes out, and we review a bunch of so me and my co-host, we each review two papers in the field that came out in the last few weeks. And we typically interview a guest, often from academia, but also from industry in the field of immunology. Mm-hmm. And I really like it because it keeps you really deep into immunology, mm-hmm, which can be sometimes hard to do when you're also doing business stuff. But papers keep being published at an ever accelerating rate. And I think it's a really important service to the scientific community, because it allows people in this field to come to a spot, get some quick updates, learn from scientists they may never get to talk to or too nervous to talk to at a conference, kind of learn that they're people, learn how they got there on their journey, learn how people think, which then kind of generates that. So maybe next time you're at a conference, you'll go up and talk to that scientist, mm-hmm, or just kind of that thought sharing of like, well, what was your big idea that led to your Nobel Prize? Or what was your big idea that led to this big paper that everyone's talking about? We see the paper, how did you get there?
Yeah.
How did that happen in reality? And so it gives, I think, especially young professionals, if they come on, it's exposure they don't get in their career, but also postdocs and grad students often don't necessarily think of their professors as people. Mm-hmm. They're like, they're just a PI on a hill. And this is like showing that they are people and really, really learning how their brains work, and that they are people with thoughts and feelings just like themselves.
Wow. Yeah. And I think that, you know, that layer of personalization is so important on all different levels across all industries as well, of giving people, you know, a more insightful look into the people behind, you know, the papers, behind the mics, things like that.
Yeah. No, I think it's a big important thing that starting to, I think, really democratize knowledge in a good way.
I agree. So if people wanted to learn more, you know, about your podcast, about you, about Ceres, where would they go?
Sure. So you can find me on LinkedIn, Ceres Therapeutics. You can Google Ceres is spelled S-E-R-E-S, and we'll pop up. And then on my Twitter handle, you can find me at Dr. Dr. S-I-F-U Sifu J-G. I'm also a martial artist, so it's a mix of being a physician and a martial artist. Or you can find us on the Immunology Podcast, which is available wherever you get your podcasts, and at immunologypodcast.com. So pretty easy to find me if you Google me as well.
Yeah. Well, great, Jason. This has been a great conversation. I appreciate you kind of breaking down all things Ceres, breaking down, you know, the SIR 109. I think it's, you know, a great thing that you guys are doing, and I'm looking forward to following the Immunology Podcast and seeing what you guys do in the future.
Great. It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, great to have you.
Hey, are you a business ninja? Want to be interviewed like this? Give us a shout. Go to www.writeforme.io. WRITEFORME.IO and schedule a time to meet with us, and we'll make it happen. Keep slaying it, y'all.